So, you've got faith over here, right? And chance over there.
And yin and yang.
Sort of, yeah.
Oh, Shiva and Shakti.
Lennon and McCartney.
Luke, Julian and Theo.
Yeah, there you go. Julian and Theo met among a million protesters in a rally by chance. But they were there because of what they believed in the first place, their faith. They wanted to change the world, and their faith kept them together. But by chance, Dylan was born.
This is him?
Yeah, that's him. He'd have been about your age. Magical child. Beautiful. Their faith put in praxis.
Praxis? What happened?
Chance. He was their sweet little dream. He had little hands, little legs, little feet, little lungs. And in 2008, along came the flu pandemic. And then by chance, he was gone.
Oh, Jesus.
You see, Theo's faith lost out to chance. So, why bother if life's going to make its own choices?
Episode 96, the Cult Matt Mark Cult Film Review Podcast. I'm Matt.
And I'm Mark.
And make sure to hit our blog at cultfilmreview.blogspot.com or shoot us an email at cultfilmreview@gmail.com. Show news? Got any show news this week?
Not too terribly much show news. I continue to put less and less effort into the podcast.
Less and less effort? How can people tell?
Well, I don't have the drops ready today, but that's okay. The listeners won't be able to tell that.
No. It'll seem like you have your shit together post-production.
Well, I can't guarantee that either.
Okay. Okay, no show news this week. This week our film is the 2006, I don't know if it's a cult classic, it's a really good film by Alfonso Cuarón. Cuarón, is that how you pronounce it?
You know, I've never really heard it pronounced, but I'm guessing Cuarón.
Cuarón, Children of Men. Plot rundown real quick. The year is 2027. The women can no longer give birth. The youngest inhabitant of the planet has just died at the age of 18, and all hopes for humanity has been lost. As civilization descends into chaos, a dying world finds one last chance for survival in the form of a woman who has become inexplicably pregnant. Now, as warring nationalistic sects clash and British leaders try to maintain their totalitarian stronghold on the country, a disillusioned bureaucrat, Clive Owen, is brought back into the fold of activism by his guerrilla ex-wife, Julianne Moore. Reluctantly, he takes on the daunting task of escorting Key, the refugee who represents humankind's last hope for survival, out of harm's way and into the care of a mysterious organization known as the Human Project. So that's it's a little long-winded.
I know you're not too bad. It got rolling there near the end. It had so much detail right at the beginning. I was worried it was going to be a real long-winded one.
No.
But I think it summed it up nicely. I mean, I guess that's the main story arc of the movie.
Yeah. So, okay, I've seen this movie many a times.
How many times? Really? Have you seen it that many times? This may be my third viewing of the film.
Maybe about that. Three or four, I think.
I really enjoy this movie. You know, you always wonder if a movie's going to wear on you, if you're not going to enjoy it as much. But this movie, I think this is just, this is one of those examples. We see it in some of the films from the 70s that we've done, where you can really see completely mature filmmaking. And this is a completely mature piece of film.
Yeah, oh yeah. It's it doesn't leave any, visually, it's rich. It doesn't have any, I don't know, cheesiness, I guess is the word. Everything is seamlessly stitched up. The details there.
It's the details there, but it doesn't talk down to the viewer like, let's say, a
Michael Bay apocalyptic movie.
You could say Michael Bay. I was thinking more of the director of E.T. What's his name?
Oh, Spielberg.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
This movie lets you figure it out on your own. I was watching it with Jean, and I think this maybe was her second viewing of the film, and we were talking about some of the plot points. And, you know, if you really were sort of half not paying attention to this movie, you could miss some stuff. Not that it's anything about the plot is necessarily circumspect or hidden. It's just that it doesn't need to show you things more than once. It's expecting that you're paying attention, like the internal struggle power in the fishes. That's such an important part of the movie. It doesn't really
the fishes show... being the guerrilla gang who are trying to overthrow, I guess, the tyrannical government of Britain, controlled by Theo goes and meets the individual. He's very, well, very kind of enigmatic.
I don't think that really sums up the fishes. That their main issue is treatment of immigrants in Britain, and where they're rounded up and basically put in ghettos. They're ghettoized, which, you know, you wonder about that. You just wonder about in a similar situation in the U.S. that this would. A policy like this would be pretty standard, I think, for most nations in sort of a world surrounded by failed states. How do you really treat immigrants?
It's very – actually, this is very standard in Australia. Australia is has a lot of cordoning of immigrants in these sort of holding pens or concentration camps before they allow them in the country, or they dispossess them to their failed states, especially since Australia is surrounded by kind of tumultuous – Southeast Asian countries
that fail from time to time. But I mean, I guess it's a very pragmatic way that states manage unwanted immigration. It's sad, I guess, but God, the fishes aren't really about overthrowing the government. They just disagree with the treatment of immigrants, immigration policy of the country. And yeah, they're largely populated by immigrants and the occasional cod, as they call them in this film.
Right. The overarching theme or point, the whole apocalypse thing, and I was thinking watching this, it's like if you didn't have a flu that made 99.999% of humanity infertile, but let's say 50%, man, wouldn't that be like a blessing to this earth if we could just take every other human being and make them infertile? Because this is probably the mellowest, most humane apocalypse that you could wish upon humanity. You know, people aren't dying in droves. It's just like the quiet, going out with a whimper.
Quietus.
Not a bang. Yeah, quietus. Yeah, that's right. What is it, quietus, when you choose when? Wasn't that the whole thing?
Yeah, I mean, I like that Jasper uses it on the mice, and he says it's very peaceful.
So, you know, I was thinking that. Agree, disagree? Like, if you took 50% of the population and made them infertile, you could reduce humans on the planet by half, roughly, over a generation or two.
Well, it'd take longer than that, but the thing I think you'd find is that societies would break down. I mean, we already see it to be a real problem now, is that some of the most prosperous societies like the U.S., they're really built on the backs of the third world and of the poor, the indentured poor of the world. And without that, you know, the whole system sort of breaks down. I mean, I know there's been a lot of improvements in automation and robotics and the ability to produce food with very little manpower. But I don't think the world's really ready to have its population reduced so drastically without some serious problems with loss of structure in society. I think this is what Alfonso Cuarón's saying here, is that you do really need the unkillable children of the poor to sort of power the furnaces of society. And without them, society breaks down.
Well, this is an interesting... the movie doesn't get into the fine details of how society is breaking down. But what is interesting is that you will eventually get men out of that tumultuous age of the early 20s, you know, the revolutionary age where men are their most violent. And, you know, you will have sort of an adult population at a certain point that has lost that fervor. And how would sort of a mature population deal with social breakdown as opposed to a young population, which has a whole different psychology associated with it? I find that kind of an interesting idea.
I think that's a good idea. There's really two ways to that. You can certainly decrease the number of young people. The problem is that will decrease the number of older people as well as that peer group moves its way through the ages. I think probably the best way to improve society in the way that you diminish the role of the young, hot-blooded males play in the activity of society. You see that maybe in the Middle East, where there's huge numbers of young people, and they're pretty hot-headed, is that you extend human life. People live 150 years, and adolescence still, even if we try to extend it as much as we can, still ends in your early 20s, whether you want it to or not. Then we've extended the amount of even-keeled, cynical middle-aged people that are more willing to compromise with the operation of society, and I think more keyed into peaceful solutions to political strife.
So what I like about this movie is it kind of gives you sort of an overview of the world chaos, but then you have Britain, and Britain is sort of this stalwart, stiff upper lip society as it's traditionally been.
Soldiers
and,
on.
Yeah, and people keep going about their day, even though there's this fraying at the edges. And this bizarre, I guess, status quo. And, you know, there's a point that Theo makes, and I forget the guy who lives in Battersea Power Station. He's the governor of Britain, or he, I don't know. They're in the book. I didn't read the book. Rose's read the book, and there's quite a bit going on with, I guess, that relationship with, I think it's Zan in the book.
I'm not familiar with the book at all. Did you say last week at the end of the podcast that the film's better than the book?
I heard that.
Where did you get that opinion from? From your wife?
No, I got that opinion from Luke Burridge in the Science Fiction Review podcast. He he said that the novel was a little bit slower. And it covers a lot of themes, I've heard. It deals a lot with, I guess, the nature of tyranny, sort of this immigration question, a lot of things, where the novel or the movie doesn't have time for that kind of thing, you know, and really kind of picks and chooses its themes that it wants to camp out on. And its main theme, you know, is when you mentioned immigration. And then the other one is just, I don't know. It's speculative. It's just about an apocalyptic situation that hasn't really been, I guess, dealt with in any other form of fiction. You get disease. Disease is a fairly common trope in apocalyptic fiction, like Stephen King's The Stand, a really good book written in 1955 by, I'm looking up at his name, it's called The Quiet Earth, or Earth Abides, I apologize. And that's sort of a disease that consumes the planet and leaves only a few human beings alive. But this is a disease that consumes the planet but just makes everybody infertile. And so you have this huge delay before the inevitable. And it's sort of this idea that, you know, if human civilization fails quickly after you die, do you have any will in the present to accomplish anything? And why would you? Because your legacy won't be remembered. And I think it gets kind of the heart of the human condition and what it is to exist in society. If there is no society after you, you know, what kind of wind does that pull from your sails? I know it would affect me deeply, but I wouldn't know why specifically, because it wouldn't be about me. I'd just live on and I'd die. And then if the Earth got smacked by an asteroid a few years after I died, you know, what should I give a shit? But it's just kind of a strange concept, thinking of humankind as a whole and you as a member of humankind, as opposed to you, the individual, which is really what we get caught up in philosophically. So,
well, I guess I understand what you're saying about if society really was failing and it would peter out a scant generation after your own death. The thing is, I can understand how that would affect you if you thought about it. But the truth is that you never really think about society going on into the future in motivating yourself for your daily life. I mean, at least I never do. I mean, I'm motivated by the simple things that I need money in my bank account, and I need food in my belly, and I need, you know, a certain amount of hours of sleep every day. And beyond that, I don't really think about the long-term activities of my life. I mean, in a sense, sure, there's great men and women in the world whose legacy lasts on well beyond their death. But that's not the case for, you know, 99.99% of people. And certainly for me, I mean, maybe not for you because you're reproducing. But for me, there's going to be, once I'm dead, I'll be scantly remembered.
I understand.
I'll just
be
another mossy grave marker.
But how? I mean, but still, if you were living in an age where in 100 years there would be no more human beings walking the planet, they'd put the zap on your head.
It would
definitely do something to you. It would definitely.
But it'd be because of that notion, not because the absence of knowledge that humanity will endeavor on, and that I will make my own small contribution to that progression. The thing that will dismotivate you is the fact that humanity's dying out. You see what I mean? It's not a removal of motivation. It's sort of like an addition of a negative motivation.
Well, it would, I think, lay bare the absurdity more of the human condition. It would definitely.
It would. Your condition is absurd, but it would certainly highlight that and make you face that absurdity more.
Right. And it would also, I think it would also nuke a lot of world religion and dogma. I think it would, you know, this whimper idea, which is contrary to most apocalyptic themes or philosophies in theology, that humankind will kind of die out. Like the Puget Sound starfish are dying out. They'll just slowly turn to mush. And
What's going on with the Puget Sound?
Oh, you didn't hear about that? They're all dying.
The purple starfish? There's zillions of them.
Yeah, they're dying. They're turning. They have this disease that's just turning them into mush. And
what?
Yeah, I know.
Oh, for fuck's sake.
There's like there's a starfish apocalypse just like a few miles from where you're at now. And, you know, see how much you care, right?
Oh, Jesus, nobody knows what it is. I think they finally figured out what the it's a virus,
yeah.
I believe.
Yeah, right. So you have apocalypse, as I like to call it, the multiple of apocalypses.
There's an interesting example. I'm sorry, I just want to stop you for a second about how this sort of slow, but in a way quick apocalypse, this sort of gentle apocalypse is coming upon the world. And you see how it affects Theo, where he sort of gives up, how we would maybe picture ourselves just sort of saying, fuck it.
He still wears a suit and tie, which I find hilarious.
Well, look, you still need money. I mean, that vodka, or that gin is not going to buy itself, right? And you still need a place to rest your head every night. The thing is that, let's look at some other people who deal with this in different ways. I mean, you can think about Nigel, his cousin.
Oh, that's who I was trying to make a reference to. He was collecting art, and that's where the question Theo brings to Nigel about, you know, in 100 years, nobody's going to give a shit.
Yeah, the movie basically asks the question we're asking ourselves out in the open. What does the film conclude? What does Nigel conclude about his thinking about this problem? Nigel said he just doesn't think about it.
Yeah, right. Well, we don't think about our, you know, mortality daily either, or we wouldn't get through the day.
I just don't see where, if the world was going to end in 100 years, it would really change our behavior that much. But maybe it would perturbate the behavior of people on a larger scale to a degree that would be enough to disrupt society and cause collapse. I could see that.
Well, I think the disruption is coming more from the demographic problem than it is anything. You know, if you could somehow take care of every age group as you did before, and you're not heightening or highlighting the slow apocalypse so much, you know, would the status quo still be maintained? And I think it would, because I think the human condition almost crutches on delusion or denial or dismissing the absurdity to get through the day.
I think people would certainly turn to religion more. I probably would in that case, which is, I always think about, I wonder if I'll return to religion later in my life when my mortality looms Oh, man. Over my head. I think there's a good chance of it. Oh, I need the warm bosom of Disillusion.
Oh, my God, dude. Give yourself more credit than that.
I don't give myself more credit than that.
In the book, there is some interesting points made about this new religion, I guess, and a religion that's kind of emerging with humanity. And it comes down to, like, the baptism of animals. Like, they have these ceremonies where they baptize newborn kittens. You see in this movie, there is not a fucking scene without a dog in it. I don't know if you noticed that. There's, like, always a dog or a cat or something.
But there's always dogs and cats with people.
Yeah, but, like, it's just everywhere. I don't know
if dogs and cats are everywhere. You know, you wonder, though, does Quran making a conscious decision to include all these dogs and cats? You wonder.
Well, it may be a nod to the novel. But the other thing I was thinking is,
what is the nod to the novel? That there's some sort of deification of animals?
Animal reproduction.
Because they continue to be able to reproduce while we cannot.
Exactly. And so, you know, if you Bob Barker would be like a pariah, I think. You know, if you are victimizing animals like you've been victimized, there might be some weird kind of dogma that emerges out of that. So, a nod to the novel, I think, is the whole idea of anything giving birth being sacred because you cannot. It's like some sort of magical superpower that you no longer possess that mm-hmm. the creatures among you do, you know. So,
I just wonder how realistic such a widespread loss of reproductive ability is. I think it's probably pretty unlikely that there wouldn't be enough genetic variability in humanity to have a fair number of outliers that wouldn't be affected by whatever the mechanism was. So, I mean, I guess it's possible. Humanity is not the most genetically diverse of species of mammals on the planet. So I guess it's possible that there's an Achilles heel hiding in our reproductive system somewhere that could be exploited. But I think it's probably pretty unlikely.
Well, you'd have to look at every single species that existed on the planet. And has there ever been a disease? Although you don't get the origin of this disease. Maybe it's artificial. Maybe it's some kind of germ warfare. But has there ever been a disease that's ever emerged in the animal kingdom that targets the reproductive organs and that's it?
Well, it'd be tough to say. You could probably only talk about modern times where you could really analyze. There was enough natural philosophers to actually note that existence. I doubt there'd be any evidence for that in the fossil record.
So the disease, you get a little bit of a hint of it when Miriam describes it in the school.
Yeah, that's a wonderfully haunting scene. Miriam talking about what it would be like to have people stop having children and for the sounds of children in playground to stop,
right?
And how it would affect life. It's interesting. Yeah. You see it to some small degree in some of the developed world where there's less and less children. I mean, you forget how omnipresent children are to most human people. But for a lot of people, you have very little interaction with them until you actually reproduce yourself.
Yeah, it's interesting because when Rose was pregnant, I saw pregnant women everywhere. Mm-hmm. They're like fucking wall to wall. I was like, what the fuck is going on? Is there like some kind of weird fertility boom? Mm-hmm. But then I realized that, no, I just don't pay attention to pregnant women when I'm not, you know, directly attached to one.
Yeah, that's right. It's like when you buy a new car, just to say something that's, I think, maybe more profound.
you notice cars that car everywhere?
All over the road. I swear to God, is everybody buying one of these sons of bitches?
Right.
But you're right. It's the exact same thing. You're paying attention to it. Otherwise,
right. And so,
I never really think about it since it's not really part of my life.
So now that we have a 3-month-old, I see women with like little carriers and strollers. I see that shit everywhere. I'm like, holy Jesus.
Where did she get that great little stroller? I'm going to have to ask her.
No, that's not me. That's my wife. And she just Amazons that shit. She'll take a picture of it and Amazon it.
I'm going to Amazon it on my phone right now.
Oh, my God. You wouldn't believe the amount of Amazon boxes filled with baby stuff that shows up at the house daily.
Did you finally subscribe to Prime?
We've been Prime members for a while. But yeah. I see the FedEx coming down the road, and I'm like, oh, okay. I just might as well stand outside my house because he's stopping in front of my house, and he does, and then he just hands me the package as I come in from work. And or either that, or I just kind of kick the two or three boxes and packages in through the front door when I'm coming home, because there's always two or three boxes sitting out in front of the house full of baby stuff I haven't a clue about.
So your baby's, what did you say, 3 months old?
3 months, yeah.
So I heard that when babies, before they switch to the sort of pulverized solid food, when they're just on a strictly liquid diet, is your baby still on a liquid diet?
Yeah, for about six months, she'll be on a liquid diet.
They don't poop a whole lot. But after that, they really start producing feces like gangbusters. Is that true?
Well, I don't know. I haven't been over the solid food hump, but I'm sure I'll be horrified to find out that that is true.
But you must see the mound of – you must be aware of like how many garbage bags full of dirty diapers you have.
Yeah, we don't – I don't want to get
that,
into it.
You don't produce that many right now.
No, we do cloth diapers because we're that, well, that really? Kind of folks.
Yeah, no, you're so – it probably uses more water and energy than disposable diapers, just to let you know.
Yeah, I know. I was thinking about that. I was trying to look at my
all that
water bill.
Sodium hypochlorite to wash that poop out.
Yeah, no. It's cognitive dissonance, I think, at this point.
It might be better for the baby's bum.
Yeah. So the empty school scene, and Miriam was talking about, which coincidentally is the name of my child. So anyway.
Oh, that's interesting, yeah. Is it spelled the same way?
Yep, spelled the same way. So she was talking about it's a infertility problem that affects the women, and they were miscarrying. The women that were pregnant during the flu were miscarrying. And then after all those babies were born, then women just no longer got pregnant. Mm. So there was some kind of it's a flu. It was a pandemic that affected men and women, and Theo – this little boy died of that flu.
No, I think this was a separate incident. There just happened to be a flu pandemic at the same time.
Really? I thought it was one and the same.
I don't believe there was a connection. I had that feeling too, but after watching this movie, because I was sort of talking about it with Gene before I watched the movie, that Theo's death was somehow related to the death, to these the infertility problem, but the movie doesn't say.
Theo's son.
Theo's son. What's his name?
Theo's name. Don't know. Moving on. All right.
Dylan.
Dylan. Okay.
So that they were connected, but they're not. I mean, all Miriam says is that there was a great flu pandemic. And that
can we just
Jasper
say it's the same?
I just don't think it's the case. I just don't think it's the case.
Anyway, but then I was thinking as time would continue, what other institutions would fall into disrepair? And what would the university system look like when the youngest person is 40 years old? I mean, would there be a university system?
I don't see. I mean, I work at a university, and all that work that's done in research is done on the backs of 20-year-olds.
Right.
Hungry 20-year-olds do all the experiments that are in the scientific publications with the kind, warm, soft-handed guidance of their mentors. But the only people you see running around like mad, putting in 12-hour days, are 22-year-olds.
Right. So what would I kept thinking, what would this world look like 20 years in the future? How would that dynamic play out where the youngest person is 40? You probably – well, they cull their old people here anyway through quietus. In the novel, I guess there's actually mass drownings of the elderly because you just get too top-heavy demographically.
Who does the drownings?
The state, I believe.
Holy shit.
Yeah, through this tyranny that isn't really described in the movie at all, but in the book it is.
That's a major problem for societies. I mean, we see it now with sort of a flat demographic in some of the developed world. Not so much in the United States, but some other countries that have even lower birth rates and very little immigration.
They're fucked. Yeah, I'm going to steer you to a Vice documentary. Is called like The Love Industry of Japan, and it flat out goes into the fact that Japanese are not fucking. And you say, oh, they're not fucking me, they're not reproducing. It's like, no, they're flat out not fucking each other. And it's weird.
Have you seen some of the anime? After you see that, you're never gonna go back to the real thing, baby.
I mean, seriously, no, there's these weird hybridized substitutes for relationships, like lounges where you just cuddle with a chick, like you pay like $80 and you just cuddle with some hot Japanese girl.
See, that doesn't make any sense. Why would you want to do that?
Good question, man. But the Japanese are wading into that shit, that weird non-sexual, non-reproductive fantasy world. I don't get, but they're going that way. And if their demographics maintain, they'll be at half the population in 100 years that they are now.
This is the sort of dissonance I see in society. We say, look, a lot of people talk about, you know, sort of sustainable populations of humanity, you know, so we can keep our society going for multi-thousands of years, is really somewhere on the order of 1 billion. And some country wants to cut its population in half when we really need to do a sevenfold population call. And it's fucking the end of the world for that country. I mean, is there no way for us to get our population under control that's not apocalypse? No.
No, you can have a... You can have a... Yeah, you're exactly true. Now, there's a bunch of snobby, I guess, uppity, green, freaky freegans out there who are willingly not breeding because they believe that breeding is bringing on the end of the world. But they're not the fuckers that are really the issue with the whole overpopulation issue. You know, it's them willingly taking themselves out of the population through not having children. That's such a rare third sigma on the statistical graph that they would never make a dent. Nobody would ever pick up that much slack to free humanity of its continuing population issues. It's never going to happen.
I did not follow it.
I don't think I made myself clear.
I'm slowly getting pretty drunk over here.
Yeah, I know. Me too. I don't think a bunch of high-minded, self-righteous assholes are going to be able to make a dent through their own actions, mm-hmm. their own snobbery, to cure ourselves of our overpopulation issue.
Of course. But the problem is, then, what's the cure?
You know,
pandemic is the only cure. Starvation, war.
We're kind of like yeast in a wort tun. You're like,
You do not want to be a yeast in a culture vat.
Yeah, why do yeasts continue to consume despite the fact that their byproduct, alcohol, is killing them, and will kill them until the beer gets about 7% alcohol, and then human beings will drink that and get drunk off their
asses. Just a simple equation that life takes. It's like, I'm just going to reproduce and one of these motherfuckers is going to make it. The most important thing is just to make as many copies as you can. The more copies you have, the chances of one making it through long term is higher.
Exactly.
If the yeast takes 10 times as long for everybody to die, what fucking difference does it make 100 of those time spans in the future?
Right. So we're slave to the same biology that any other critter's slave to.
So you know what the only solution is?
Robots.
Yeah, robots. Yeah, we get down to robots again. It always comes back to robots.
Fucking robots. The Skynet. Clean that shit out. Cure us of our problems. So we've kind of talked about, I guess, the main theme, or at least what we took away from.
And maybe that's why this movie speaks to us. You wonder if this speaks to other people. I think this movie was highly thought of, though. I didn't see if it won any awards.
Well, sci-fi never wins awards, so probably not.
This is pretty digestible science fiction, though.
Well, it's very realistic and plausible science fiction. Mm-hmm. I mean, despite the whole nature of the disease and whether that's even possible or not, that's kind of small potatoes in the whole scheme of viability. And to me, the kind of the slow apocalypse, I think, is rendered extremely well. I think the human condition, human instinct is captured vividly in this, how things would actually look, you know, as opposed to some stupid nuclear apocalypse where radioactive mutants, you know, turn into professional wrestlers and, you know, maraud the wasteland for oil or whatever. This is like way more vivid and realistic. I think that's why, to me, this movie is pretty exceptional.
Absolutely. Though I was wondering, if the whole world had collapsed, why do personal electronics continue to advance?
Yeah, man. I don't know. Yeah, I was wondering that too. Like, wow, the cars have come a long way. It'll tell you if like there's an impact imminent and you know, all that groovy stuff.
I think people forgot that all this cheap electronics bullshit is built by the masses of the young poor. I mean, there's not a 40-year-old guy building that iPhone 5C you got in your hands. That's some 19-year-old that came from a poor farm village of a family that didn't have enough work or food at the homestead.
Yeah. Well, you would get a lack of innovation, right? It would plateau because all your 20-somethings would be gone. And they're usually the geniuses of our society.
Yeah, I mean, what do they say about engineers when they turn 40?
Well, yeah, that's from Primer.
They take them out back and shoot them.
Yeah, they take them out back and shoot them. Yeah, for good reason. I'm 40, man. You should take me out back and shoot me. I'm almost worthless.
I think that maybe that age threshold has been moved up a little bit at your particular place of employment.
Yeah, I think the average age of my place of employment is 53. So it's like Children of Men inside of a corporation.
Yeah, if they shot all their engineers at 40, they would have no engineers.
Yeah. Well, they should shoot them at 50. That's what they should.
That would work out pretty well.
Fucking really shoot them.
It's only 10 years. I guess it doesn't make that much of a difference.
So let's talk about the filmmaking.
Oh, yeah.
About this. And I think there's a lot to chew on. There's, I guess, what we would call the cinematic long shot stunt. And we got that in Hard Boiled, where you have an action sequence that goes on for an extremely long period of time. And
that's sort of a stunt.
It is a stunt, yeah. But it's weird because you don't realize it's a stunt. You're watching it, and if you weren't paying attention that, oh, hey, this is the 5-8 minute, I forget how long that shot is.
In Hard Boiled, I didn't notice it at the time. You pointed it out to me.
But in this film, did it really stand out?
Well, there's a few of these scenes where it's one or maybe two shots stitched together to be indistinguishable from one very long shot. I mean, there's certainly the shot in the car with the ping pong ball, which was sort of weird, and then the whole shooting incident.
Well,
there's
that,
also the shot through the building during the firefight.
Yeah, let's stop. Okay, that scene, I'm talking about the action in this movie and how the action is extremely gripping as opposed to action in most films. Like, I was thinking about action in most films and just, you know, how bored. Like, you just want to take a nap during the action sequences. But this movie has, I don't know, it has limited action scenes, but each action scene is extremely gripping and thrilling. Like, the first scene when they're driving out and there's the ambush.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know why that scene, it's very visceral. You get, like, Julianne Moore's character, spoilers, getting shot in the head.
What? She gets shot in the neck, by the way.
Shot in the neck. And they're reversing out of the ambush, and it's almost like some kind of weird barbarian horde descending out of the forest at them.
Mm-hmm.
There's the guy on the bike, which is that crazy fucking dreadlocked fucker.
That's one of the more interesting sort of characters. Well, you never really know his name.
I think it's kind of a brilliant way to discern certain parties in the movie. You see that guy a lot. He's like almost and like you see him in chaos. Like you see him in that scene in what's the ghetto? I forget the ghetto called the Sex Hill or something like that.
Yeah, Bexhill.
Bexhill. Oh, they changed it to Sex Hill. Is that like sort of a graffiti thing? Is what they did?
Anyway, they might have in one of the signs, yeah.
So, but you see him because he has those crazy dreadlocks, and you need that kind of visual meme to ground yourself in the action because you always know who those people are.
Yeah. You're
like, oh, like it would take you a while if that dude wasn't there to associate him with what the fish is at that gorilla group, the fish.
The fish, yeah. That's a real, you know, I never really realized how that, whenever he's with a group of basically plainclothes fighters, that it's really a deft little trick of filmmaking to be a real instant cue to, you know, what group this identically clothed bunch of people carrying AK-47s are.
Yeah, and that guy has no character. He's just a thug.
He's just
a wild man. Mm-hmm. But you see him in, like, all the poignant scenes, in the action scenes, and you're like, oh, okay, that's that guy. Okay, he's representing the group. And
yeah.
I thought that was really nice because, like, in novels, I always have a hard time pulling names out of you know, the drama. Like, okay, who's this? Okay, you know, especially when they start with the same letter. It's really confusing. Like when novels do that, they'll have like three or four characters with the same letter in their first name, and I always get them confused, and I always get sort of, I guess, discombobulated. But in this movie, they do this. The director does the brilliant thing of giving somebody a visually striking note that you're like, oh, okay. So like nothing's ever really confusing. In a very confusing visually movie, which I think is a good idea.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, this movie could be really confusing, but the movie, the director really gives you just enough to go on to really keep it straight, as long as you're paying attention.
Yeah. So you get a chase scene, you get that reverse chase scene, which is great. Mm-hmm. And then there's the scene when they're escaping the farmhouse.
Yeah, that's also one very long shot that's really nice. Perfectly set up, definitely set up with all the little bits of dialogue. You know, like earlier they set up the car needs to be jumped to start. And Theo's incredible ability to, for some reason, they still have distributor caps in these cars in 2027.
Yeah, you don't think they've gone to digital electric and sparking? Yeah.
My
yeah,
super cheapo Japanese car has all electric ignition. It does not have a distributor cap, but I guess.
Well, maybe let's be fair. That's like an old movie trick.
That's a little bit of a meme. Yeah, yeah.
You know, I remember in Red Rock West, it's Nick Cage goes and pulls the distributor cap out of Lyle from Dallas's Barracuda or whatever and chucks it into the weeds, you know.
But in
out.
A sense, he doesn't really do that. I mean, he could just be pulling off the spark plug leads, which in a hurry your car is going to be, you're going to have a lot of troubles if you have no, I mean, that's something you could easily pull off most cars, is their spark plug cables.
True. Yeah, you just grab them. And
so maybe that's all he's really pulling off. I mean, all internal combustion cars still have those. Yeah. I don't know if they're super easily accessible, but
anyway, they do an interesting thing, or the director does an interesting thing with the camera. He has like a camera suspended in the car that's on a swivel. I don't know if you've noticed that.
Yeah, he uses that in the first long shot scene as well.
Yeah, it keeps you right in the middle of it, and it's a long shot, and it gives you the perspective of one of the characters. Like, you're kind of the sixth character in the car.
Don't see how they keep everybody in focus. It must have been some amazing bit of lens work he was doing, because you put it going through the middle of the roof of the car, you're going to be a foot away from these actors' faces when you're taking photos of them.
You do some trickery. I think you use a wide angle, and then you maybe use some sort of post-processing software to tighten it all up.
Yeah, maybe. It's pretty amazing. It really feels like you're there, which I guess is what Quaron was going for, and it was effectively done.
Then there's the combat scene, which I think was leveraging a lot of visual style from the Iraq War at the time, which Britain and the U.S. were both involved in, obviously.
Yeah, this movie has a lot of overtones of the War on Terror bullshit.
Yeah, it's interesting because it's the Department of Homeland Security. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just like it is. And then when they pull Miriam off the bus, you get sort of those cages.
Yeah, the old Al Ghraib.
Yeah, you get Abu Ghraib.
Prison?
Abu Ghraib.
Yeah, quickly we've forgotten about it.
I know, but that's the crazy thing is, like, when I was watching this in 2007, it's like, wow, they're really, you know, they're really
hitting you over the head with it.
But, you know, give it 10 years.
Yeah, and I mean, anybody who was 10 at the time and now is 20 seeing this movie doesn't see it at all.
Yeah.
It's not like it's in his history textbook.
Yeah, which is crazy. Like, that visual of the dude standing on the box with the kind of the black hood over his head, you know, that's all washed. That's washed away. Our media has chosen to completely disinfect itself from that shame. And, you know.
Well, it's not so much, at least people who experience it can remember it. The problem is young people won't.
No, and I think that's the main
problem of the short lifespans of humans. It's just sort of,
yeah.
It's sort of where, I mean, the idea that our lifespans are so short sort of sentences us to live history over and over again and continually make the same mistakes as a species. It's a real shame.
Yeah, well, I think our media is designed to forget the past extremely quickly, because if you start laying out the past, especially of the United States, in sort of our current time frame of the past 10 to 15 years, and you kind of beat on that drum, you would have to be of low IQ to not make the association that you're living in an extremely corrupt, fucked up society that needs a massive overhaul to continue to function. If you just start, you know, but our media is hell bent on amnesia. If we didn't have amnesia, if you didn't forget how, you know, recent some of this stuff is, then there'd, people would be pissed off. Like, I keep telling people, it's like, do you, when we were bombing Libya again, I was like, do you remember why we were bombing Libya the first time? And people would be like, oh, Pan Am 106 or whatever it was, the 747 that blew up over Lockerbie, Scotland. It's like, oh, well, they blew up our jetliner. It's like, no, that was after we bombed. That was a response to the bombing. That was a terrorist act responding to the bombing.
See, I didn't know that.
The original reason is so obscure and bizarre that people would scratch their head and go, what? And it was a disco bombing in Hamburg, Germany or something, allegedly performed by a Libyan-sponsored terrorist that bombed some disco where U.S. servicemen hung out.
Oh, that's why the U.S. gave a shit about it.
Fucking A. And then we parked like three aircraft carriers in the Gulf of Sidra and waited and antagonized the shit out of Gaddafi until he, you know, he challenged that territorial domain. And we bombed the shit out of him afterward. I was just like, nobody even understands why we did that. Nobody even understand. Nobody cares. You know?
I think that's the key point. Nobody cares. Mm.
But would you really, if it wasn't for a bulwark of information that blocked that history from the American public?
No, you know, be quite honest with you, I probably wouldn't even care either way.
Well, you wouldn't, but that's because we're cynical bastards. Just give up, you know, giving a shit.
I mean, the point is it's a dog-eat-dog world. And the most important part is to be on top of this dog bile.
True. So this movie obviously leverages some current affairs which is good science fiction, I think.
This is solid stuff. Solid stuff all around.
And the long shot, you know, where they go into that building and military shows up and starts shooting the shit out of it. And you get the baby crying.
Yeah.
And I turned into like a big fucking softie, man.
Like I was wondering how your newfound reproduction would affect
my newfound
experience
reproduction
of this.
I have this wiener and I don't know what to do. Oh, I know. I reproduce with it. My God.
No, I'm not making a joke of it. I'm quite serious about it.
This scene affected me when I first saw it. I guess it's heightened because now I have a child. But how the action he takes the action just to a dead stop. Mm-hmm. When the baby's crying, you know, and everybody can hear the baby crying. And it's weird how, like, nobody gives a shit that they're getting shot at or they're laying siege to a building. And they just pass through the scene almost like as if they hit pause. And it's like a religious experience for, like, the soldiers and the refugees. And see a lot of people making religious signs. And
there's like an African woman singing a song, even though she's bleeding out of her pelvis.
Right. And then there's a couple of soldiers that are kneeling down and doing whatever it is, the Hail Mary or the, you know, the what is that? The Trinity. The Catholics do it. I don't know. They're touching their head
and
stuff.
They're just signing the cross.
Right. And so, you know, I was thinking about something so common that when it's taken away from the human condition becomes religious.
For a while,
but still, yeah. But it was still kind of a crazy scene.
That's an amazing scene. I mean, that's just an amazing, profound piece of filmmaking.
Yeah, and I totally, like, I turned into a big, like, sad baby. Like, I was tearing up for that scene.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't tear up often during movies, and especially not for Steven Spielberg hackery emotional extortion, which he loves to do. Like, this is an authentic I think moment that you have in this film, at least I did, where it wasn't extorted or it wasn't contrived. It was meant to be, I think, open to interpretation, but in such a way that is so evocative that it's like not a trick. It's not a. It was just authentic. It was an amazing piece of film.
That scene lays bare the absurdity of our societal existence. That we're busy shooting each other when what we really care about is living.
Yeah, well, there's going on there.
Yeah, it's just, it just lays bare the absurdity of everyday life that's been, you know, brought into terrible contrast by this apocalypse.
Well, and like any good piece of art, any good art there.
Real good art?
Any real good art.
No, this is better than real good art.
It evokes and you take away from it what you want or what you need or what inspires you. And I think that scene would hit different people, you know, in different ways. And if you're religious, it would hit you in a certain way. If you're a cynical atheist like me, it would soften you up. And it totally softened me up. And I don't know. There's very few moments in filmmaking like that. That scene with the baby crying that I think that I'll just continue to remember.
It's a profound scene. I mean, I think the most profound part about it for me is that even when people are slapped in the face and they realize the whole world around them has gone crazy and that they forgot what really matters, even if they realize it for a moment, they'll go back to their old behaviors just like that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And that's the crazy thing is that once they walk past through the cordon that's made for them for the soldiers and they get beyond the tank line, they just start shooting the shit out of each other again.
That's the most profound part of the movie for me. I mean, is that moment where even if we realize we're behaving in ways that are just absurd, we just almost, at least en masse, we're almost powerless to change that.
Yeah, totally.
I guess that's cynicism, unfortunately.
Yeah, well, but I don't know. It takes a lot to chip away at my cynicism, but this movie managed to do it a little bit.
Well, look, it's very evocative, which is what we've said over and over again. It's been the main theme of the podcast about being evoked.
Before we go into the review, just a little bit of the characters. I think the characters are really well painted. Everybody has some depth to them. They don't do them a disservice by forcing a backstory onto you.
No, but all the characters seem real. I mean, what we need is a sequel starring Sid.
Oh, Sid the fascist pig.
He's, I know, great. What a,
yeah,
son
he
of
is
a bitch.
He is great. Well, it's weird because you see him, and he's just a bribed policeman. And at this point in society, you know, who the fuck cares if you're corrupt? That was kind of my opinion. Dope smoking cop, and he gets him in, and he apparently still thinks that who's the Michael Caine character?
Jasper.
Jasper's still alive because they don't ever correct him.
Well, they wouldn't want to. I mean, he's doing Jasper a favor. Why would you want to tell him Jasper's dead? That'd be insane.
And so then Jasper shows up in disguise, I guess, at the flop house where
you're talking about Sid shows up at the flop house.
Sid shows up at the flop house. And somewhere along the line, he's learned the nature of that Key and Theo. And
he's seen that they're wanted by the government and that he surmises that the fish are breaking into Beck's Hill and he realizes that something big is happening and he's going to want to get his piece of the action.
Well, there's a personal gain, and what his personal gain is, I'm not exactly sure.
Just money.
I guess money. Yeah.
Yeah. That's all it is. He's a pretty straightforward, he's probably one of the more honest characters, maybe aside from Key in this whole movie. I mean, he's honestly just a bastard.
I know.
He's got to respect that to a certain extent.
He's a great bastard. And he gets killed by a car battery over the head. Oh, should fucking do you in.
Oh, God. Those things are fucking heavy.
Yeah, we had a whole discussion on car batteries. What was the last episode? So, yeah, and I liked the gypsy woman. I think she was a gypsy. I don't really remember.
Amrica or something along those lines? Yeah, I think she's supposed to be Roma. That's tough to tell. I don't really know my European minorities well enough.
Well, there's a scene that, because let's face it, Roma are I guess probably one of the more stereotyped groups of human beings on
the planet. You would imagine in an apocalypse situation, might not be the worst group of people to be allied with, as long as you escape being systematically killed by a state.
There's one crazy scene, and it's when they're escaping Sid.
Yeah.
And they pass the baby through the door to her, and you see her disappear.
But she doesn't, and, though.
No, but that's crazy, because it like totally calls you out. You're like, oh, that fucking bitch stole their kid. You
and know, she's I, back a second later.
Yeah, and you're like, oh, fucking, you know, dirty gypsy stealing kids. Because yeah. my grandmother, bless her heart, always told me if I was really bad, the gypsies would steal me. And I didn't know the fuck she was talking
look,
about.
Look, I would avoid, there's not any real Roma up in the west coast of the United States. But believe me, I'm not going to have anything to do with any Roma people.
I'll tell you what, man. I was in Paris, and they're everywhere. You know, Sarkozy was giving them one-way plane tickets back to Romania. And he was like, get them the fuck out. And I was like, oh, that racist pig, fucking bastard. But you walk around the tourist sites in Paris especially, you know, which has a land bridge, I guess, to Eastern Europe where a lot of the Roma are from. And they're swindling, man. They're swindling at every one of those fucking sites. They got the little gimmicks and games that they try to pull on you. It happened to me a couple of times. They're very easy to see. They're very colorful. You know, you get sort of the pseudo quasi cripples playing some strange instrument in front of art museums, and of course, you know, you feel obligated to pitch a few bucks at them or euros or whatever. They're living true to their stereotype. They haven't, you know, risen above it. It's strange, I guess. So
yeah, I mean,
but that seems crazy because
if you don't
I was
live with it. It's tough to be critical of somebody being critical of some social group. That's sort of a pain in the ass. You know, it's interesting. You talk about like some sort of swindle about an amputee. There was a God. I tell you, I swear to God, this country is turning into some sort of third world country. You realize?
Swear
that,
to God, huh? All
right. That, how many people beg for money at the side of on and off ramps on roads? Was that ever the case when we were children? Was there ever people hanging out at every fucking on ramp asking for money?
No, the economy's shit. But there was something I heard from. I forget. I was listening to some radio program or podcast, and they said he was challenging those people. And I don't know why it was from
who
some,
was.
The guy who was talking on this podcast. Mm. I don't know who he was. And he was offering to buy their signs for $20.
Mm.
And that was some kind of, I forget, if they went for it, then they weren't really in need. He had discerned or, you know, come up with that concept. Or if they didn't offer it, then they were really in need, and he gave them the $20 anyway.
$20 is a pretty low ball offer for some sign somebody had to cobble together for a day's work.
What's crazy though is if you look at those little kind of off ramp squats, you'll see a pile of cardboard off to the side, and there's literally like a pile of cardboard where people dispose of their signs. It's kind of crazy.
Well, you know, the point I was going to make is, at an on-ramp that I go by every day from work going home, there's literally an amputee sitting there begging for money.
Amputee, like somebody in a wheelchair, something like that?
He's missing an arm. He puts his stump out. It goes out about 2 inches from his shoulder.
So do you then go get out of your car and then flip him out of the wheelchair and call him a goldbreaker?
I beat him in his kidneys. It's like, no, this I'm just saying that we're getting pretty serious. I mean, it's not just some guy acting like he's had a tough break.
Yeah, no, I'm with
it's
you.
It's literally there's a guy with a fucking missing arm begging for money. It's pretty
okay,
sad.
These weren't the Roma I was seeing on the streets of Paris. I think they were, I think they could get up and walk away from their malady or whatever was affecting them. Anyway, but this movie, I guess it called me out. I was like, oh, that gypsy's going to steal their kid. I fucking know it. And then she came right back. I thought that was kind of interesting how it was fairly innocent, but it definitely played with your preconceptions, you know. So
it's tough to know. Preconceptions are pretty useful, but sometimes they can be a bit of a trap.
All right. So we're getting on the hour. So let's hit the review.
Ebert reviewed this film on the 4th of October of 2007. Gave it 4 stars, which I believe is his highest rating.
It is his highest rating.
He talks a bit about sort of the setup of the film, which we've covered in this review. But he says about the setting that there are, most disturbing of all, no children. Only dogs and cats remain to be cared for and cherished. You wonder if Ebert's aware of the book, as you mentioned earlier, about the importance of dogs and cats. And I think that's an interesting insight that maybe I didn't really... I can certainly see now, and it certainly affected me, but not really on a conscious level. I think that's a pretty nice insight by Ebert.
Definitely. Yeah, Bob Barker is publicly enemy number one in this future, I would say.
Bob Barker aside, he talks about Theo, the film's hero, which is true. And he says that during the initial scene in the movie, during the bombing of the cafe, which is an absolutely fucking gripping
scene. That's crazy. That's
pre-credits.
Like
credits.
And then you just get the credit, and then that's, it's just like, whoa, pretty, right, something's going pretty, on, pretty, crazy.
Pretty amazing opening for a film. But he says that the character Theo crouches in fear at the sight of this bombing. And he says, this will not be like action pictures where the hero never seems to fear death. You're right. The hero in this movie has all the fears we all have.
I went through the trivia, and there is not a scene where Theo handles a gun. He's constantly surrounded by guns and threatened and attacked with guns, but he never actually has a gun in his own hand at any point in the film.
Well, there's no point in the film where a gun would really benefit him.
No.
It would benefit the hot-headed maniac who thinks he can fight his way out of the farm. But the truth, the only way to get out of there with Key was to escape by deception, which
yeah, right.
is what he did. He talks about the long chase scene that we talked about earlier that is one of the most sudden and violent moments I've ever seen in a film. Not all of the chases in all of the Bournes, like talking about the Bourne films, equal this one shot in a single take by one camera, which
yeah,
I think
and,
is a pretty impressive statement right there.
And the stakes are so high in that chase scene because he loses Key. In the single shot, like, loses Key. Like, she's
Julian.
Fish. What?
He loses Julian.
Julian. Well, okay. No, I'm thinking of the battle scene.
Oh, you're thinking of the battle? Oh, I was thinking
is
of
that
the car
chase scene? Oh, the car
scene. He's
talking
about the car scene.
Oh, he's talking about the car scene. Oh, okay. All
right.
Well,
but
still,
right,
the
there's two
are...
scenes, basically, that are better than all of the action scenes of these three Bourne movies, which are all about action.
I know, isn't that fucking crazy?
Isn't it weird?
And it's not even an action movie. This isn't really an action movie.
No, not really, but it has tons of action in it.
It's fucking crazy.
He talks about the action and the violence. He says, too many action scenes look like slick choreography, but Coran and Owen get the scent of fear and death in their scenes, which I think is... He says, even in the midst of a firefight, dogs scamper in the streets. He says, Theo's hand reaches out to touch and reassure the nearest animal. And he says, I was reminded of Jack London's belief that dogs, not cats so much, see us as their gods.
I know. I rule over my dogs like an angry god from fucking medieval literature.
Apparently, sterility affects only humans on Earth. When we are gone, will the dogs still tirelessly search for us? I just can't imagine he's not familiar with the book. Does he really see all that in this film?
That's
incredible insight on Ebert's. If he's the only thing that he's drawing that from is from this film.
No, I think he must, like me, have gotten a hint from some kind of review of the novel or something that the role that dogs and cats take in this future society, I would have to think.
I would guess. If not, he's a genius, which I guess he is to a certain extent, even though some of his reviews are a little... not so well written. So here we go into one of the favorite words of all modern film reviewers, and Ebert talks about it for a paragraph here. I have been using Hitchcock's term MacGuffin too much lately, but there are times when it will only do. The lack of children and the possibility of children are the MacGuffins in this film. He says, the children added MacGuffin is simply a dramatic device to avoid actual politics when showing us how the world is slipping away from civility and coexistence. It's interesting, the idea that the whole society could fail without something as profound as this happening. We don't really need the lack of children to bring world into madness. I mean, I'm just thinking about World War One, which I'm still in the midst of listening to an audiobook about it. The whole world fell into absolute fucking madness. I mean, this, at least the Western civilized world did. And people were still having kids.
Okay, I'm going to pull a Lumberg, and I'm going to go ahead and disagree with Ebert on this one. I think that it's not truly a MacGuffin, because that concept is so evocative, and that it adds to the stakes significantly in the action in this film. Unlike, when I think of a MacGuffin, I think of the classic suitcase in Pulp Fiction that, you know, has this golden shimmer when everybody opens up. The implications of that case aren't, it's absolutely independent of the action. But the MacGuffin here, maybe he's right. Maybe you could carry this whole drama out, not using children or the lack of children as the MacGuffin. But to me, it brings such immediacy to the film that I don't think, I think it's less a MacGuffin. I don't really agree with him there.
I think you're right. I don't think it's 100% a MacGuffin. It's part of MacGuffin. You could make a similar film without it if you wanted to delve into the politics, as he said, and set up a world where, you know, society fell apart and into war and chaos. But it wouldn't be the same film.
Yeah, agreed. Yeah.
He says, I'm just going to say one statement in the next paragraph. He says, the climax, in my opinion, is open-ended. And that's something I did want to bring up, even if we're going to touch on it briefly, is that this movie has a rather uplifting and I think not open-ended ending.
Well, for starters, I don't think you could piece together humanity from one pregnancy, even if it was a newborn girl.
But you're going to have to try. You're going to have to impregnate this girl as much as you can.
Well, maybe you could do something with it, but...
Plus, the child is a female, which maybe she carries that trait. And when she becomes of reproductive age.
But, I mean, if something, some disease has scarred all the wombs of the world to a point that they will never produce children, I don't know how you can reverse bioengineering.
The only thing you can turn to is gay sex, hot gay sex.
Yeah, this would be a free reign of hedonism, man. This world, you could fuck like crazy and... not fuck up.
The problem.
Any
the
kids
problem was
as a result,
marijuana is still illegal.
What the fuck is up with that?
You could probably still get AIDS.
I was watching this movie, and that was the most absurd part of this future dystopia that was falling in ruin. I was like, weed is still fucking illegal in Britain? I was like, are you kidding me? I mean, come on, for fuck's sake, people! I was like, that's absurd. All right.
At the end of this review. Ebert gets rather poetic in his language, and I'm just going to read the last bit here, and you can tell me your thoughts. Here is certainly a world ending, not with a bang, but with a whimper.
I said that.
And the film serves as a cautionary warning. The only thing we will have to fear in the future, we learn, is the past itself. Our past. Ourselves.
Very dramatic.
What is he saying
there? Review.
I didn't see that. I don't get it. What are you talking about? Why are we fearing the past?
The only thing we will have to fear in the future, we learn, is the past itself. I think maybe he was just tired and thought that sounded great. But
it sounds nice.
Let's maybe try to give him some credit. I'm thinking it might be like what I was talking about. That our past, I guess the status quo, just continues on no matter the absurd condition that we live in, whether it's war or how shitty we treat each other. I don't know. Whatever.
I don't think that's what he's talking about, but I don't know what he's talking about.
Fucking
all right, give done.
Up. All right, okay. Anything else on the Children of Men?
I should really see some of Ebert's other movies. I mean, Cuarón's other films, but I haven't.
Didn't he do Harry Potter?
Oh, you know, that's right. I did. I really did enjoy The Prisoner of Azkaban. I thought it was a pretty damn good Harry Potter film. Ebert didn't like it as much as the first two. I thought it was much better.
You're speaking to a Harry Potter boycotter right here.
Just wait till your daughter grows up to be like 8 or 9 years old. She's going to burn through those Potter books like you wouldn't believe.
That's fine. As a mature 40-year-old adult, I will not read or watch children's fiction about some fucking little wizard boy. I'm not.
You could literally
it.
Read that whole series in about 12, 13 hours.
I don't care. I'm not. I'm putting my foot down. I've dismissed the whole J.K.
They're pretty good.
Rowling.
They're pretty good young adult books.
You keep telling me. I'm
they're
not
pretty
doing
solid.
It.
I mean, they got a nice little storyline. It peters out a bit the last three books. But the first four are solid. Solid adventure tales.
All right. I'm not doing it.
I don't think you wouldn't enjoy the first four.
It will take my daughter to bring me into the Potter fold. And until that moment, I'm staring away. That's fine.
You stay away from it, but I think you probably end up enjoying those first ones at least. At least the first three.
All right. Well, give me some time before I.
I think they'd be a good a book out loud to read. Yeah.
I get like a systemic reaction to everything, to everything that everybody's into. Like I just get this like sort of autoimmune response to pop culture manias. I'm just like, fuck it. If everybody's into it, it must be shit. So,
okay, man, just read the thinly veiled Christ tale that C.S. Lewis wrote in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. The next thing you know, your daughter's going to be going to church.
He's a fucking hack, man. He couldn't even invent his own creatures and monsters. He had to borrow them from myth.
Yeah,
it's like going to the...
That and Tolkien, that other hack.
Oh, yeah, he's a hack, too. All right. Okay, so next week, you know, I had a lot of movies to choose from because I'm a big fan of Richard Linklater. And he's done a ton of shit. He's sort of like a Soderbergh. He's done comedies, dramas, sort of quirky indies, sci-fi. And, you know, I settled on The Scanner Darkly or A Scanner Darkly because it was the first Philip K. Dick book I read. And I don't remember the movie. I've seen only like once or twice. But I think it was a bold movie and I like the actors in it who strangely are playing burnouts and are actually burnouts themselves, which
that's
I find
true.
Like them almost playing themselves. It has like Woody Harrelson, Robert Downey Jr., and then kind of wash ups who are playing wash ups, Winona Ryder and Keanu Reeves, which it's crazy. It's crazy casting and it works. And it's a really good movie. I know a lot of people don't like rotoscoping. I found it fine. But,
I'm not a big fan of the rotoscoping. I think I would have rather us go with the girlfriend experience, but
that's not a Linklater movie.
It's not on a Linklater. It's not.
It's
on
a Soderbergh movie.
Oh, Soderbergh. Shoot. Yeah. Well, forget it.
No, I was thinking about like a Before Sunrise, Before Sunset, because those are the only romantic, I guess, romantic comedy, if you want to call them a comedy film, that I actually really like. Or
the thing
or
is,
Slacker. But
yeah, Slacker. I've never seen that, but there's some great bits of dialogue in A Scanner Darkly. Some solid
it
dialogue.
Is.
I think it's gonna be pretty enjoyable. I'm looking forward to seeing it.
So that'll be part of us not doing the same director for the first 100 films. We'll have maintained that.
Almost. We're almost to the end.
Almost to the end. Well, assuming that 100 will be the end, but I think we'll keep going.
Well, that's right. We're going to do only films we like. But I'm still
That's right.
I'm going to. So, Matt, did you like this movie better than my previous pick, Pink Flamingos?
That was my pick, by the way. You gave me the director, and I had to pick.
Right.
It was like, here's the garage sale. Pick what you want out of it. It's gonna, you know, and you can take it home. And
no
I'm like,
what
all
you
right.
pick, it's gonna blow.
Yeah, it's like, you know, finding a suit in the Value Village rack. You know, find the best suit there. Like, all right,
well, I'll buy you the best suit at Value Village.
Yeah, no, this was a movie I really enjoyed quite a bit.
Yeah, this is
a
great film.
Anyway, until next week.
I'm a lot more successful now.
Well, did you hear this natural order? Those most deserving will end up with the most. That the cream cannot help but always rise up to the top. Well, I say, shit floats. If you thought things had changed, friends, you better think again. Bluntly put, in the fewest of words, counts are still running the world. Counts are still running the world. Yeah.
Now the working classes are obsolete. They are surplus to society's needs. So let them all kill each other and get it made overseas. That's the word, don't you know, from the guys that's running the show. Let's be perfectly clear, boys and girls. Oh, cunts are still running the world. Cunts are still running the world.